Here we go. Take 4, 5, or 6. Starting completely over from the top. Church, do not bite that. Hey, it's me. Welcome to Jelly. This is a podcast where it's been so long since I've done a new episode, I completely forgot the original intro. So that's what it's going to be now. I'm just going to jump ahead and introduce myself. I am your host, Genevieve Rose. This is the podcast, Jelly, J-L-E. Much has happened in my absence. The last story on here was an episode about a YouTuber who, surprise, surprise, lied on the internet for financial gain, and it appears that things have only gotten worse for her. Holidays have also come and gone. I have traveled and come back. Mother's Day is around the corner. I also found out my service dog of 10 years, now unofficially retired, affectionately known as Squid, Tiva, was diagnosed with prostate cancer, which I thought was complete bull and expected him to die immediately. But fortunately, treatment is going well. That treatment is chemo once a month. He's since gotten 2 treatments. Yes, they do cancer treatments for dogs. Believe it or not, they also do radiation. He does not appear to need that at this point, so it's just IV chemo. What a world we live in. The biggest issue for me right now is getting him to eat enough food. He really won't eat animal food. So I just have been making him varieties of people food, pretty much what I eat. He did eat really well yesterday and also today, so that's good. Initially, I was devastated and I invested heavily in retail therapy because I no longer believe in real therapy. But now I think I'm handling it better. What else? What else? St. Elvis. She turned 1 in January. That is my beautiful Siamese cat. Church is 10 months old. That is my cat's cat. She is a little black cat that craves mischief and is a total cuddle bug. Earlier today, she ran out of my apartment into my neighbor's across the hall because the door was open. And my neighbor has a cat of her own that apparently does not like men. Fortunately, her cat was locked in the bathroom, but then I had to go over there all awkward and apologetic and retrieve my rebel girl from beneath a stranger's bed, which was uncomfortable for more than one reason. That, however, is a prime example of a day in the life of mine. I believe the purpose of the internet is to curate and distribute cute and humorous animal-related content. If you agree with that philosophy, you can find that on my personal Instagram. While you're at it, please follow the Instagram for the JLE Podcast, which is exactly that, at JLE Podcast. And you can leave a review for the show wherever you listen, 5 stars preferred. Stick around to the end of this episode and I will tell you the separate story about the time I tried an edible and I thought my animals were plotting against me. I do have a list of requested true crime topics to cover here. One of those is Lizzie Borden. This could also fit into the categories of other requests I've received, such as female killers in particular, femme fatales. Someone requested ancient murders. This murder itself with Lizzie Borden isn't ancient, but it is old. I've also gotten requests to cover JonBenet Ramsey, which I probably won't do, if I'm being honest, because it's so frustrating. The case was botched from the beginning. It's this endless string of questions. There are no answers. It drives me nuts, and it's really just a reminder of what can happen when people don't do their job right. The only thing I can think that Ramsey and Borden have in common is that both of their homes had back staircases, which I find fascinating. This is a historical audio tour of the Lizzie Borden home in Fall River, Massachusetts. 5 points if you can spell Massachusetts. It's okay, I'll do it for you now. Massachusetts. Courtesy of the YouTube channel called The Paranormal Files. I will link the entire video in the description. This episode is part one, the history. Part two will be a following episode about the hauntings at the Borden home. Episode one, the history of the Borden home. The historical information is courtesy of Fall River tour guide Phil. To paint a picture here, Phil has a friendly looking oval shaped face with dark facial hair and thick eyebrows. His ears stick out slightly, as does his short, wavy hair beneath his dark baseball cap that matches his puffer jacket. To me, he seems like the devoted friend some woman would end up falling in love with, because he's the guy that's been there for her the entire time. Good job, Phil. On with the tour. 230 2nd Street in Fall River, Massachusetts, is a home that was built in 1845, so a long time ago. And it wasn't until 1875 when Andrew Borden purchased the home and moved his family in. Occupying the house was Andrew himself, his second wife, Abby Borden, his oldest daughter, Emma, and his youngest daughter, Lizzie. I'm going to go ahead and offer an overview of the home layout, even though it's impossible for me personally when people do that and they're describing an area. And this was in the back corner, and this was, I don't know, but I will try, because I'm sure there are some of you out there who can picture a blueprint better than I can. So it's essentially, well, there's the first floor, there's upstairs, there's a room where the attic is, and then the basement. So I guess you could say it's a two-story, like a functional two-story. So when you walk in, there's a front entryway, and then the staircase is right there going upstairs. So if you go to your left, there's a parlor room, which is like a formal sitting room. And each of the rooms have doorways, so they all kind of interconnect on the first floor and the second floor. So you walk in the front entry, to the left is the parlor room, and then if you keep walking through the front entry, you go straight, that's the sitting room. That's where Andrew Borden's body was found. Off of the sitting room is the dining room. In the back of the first floor is the kitchen, and then from the kitchen, you have the back entryway, was kind of like a sink area, a pantry, and then from there is the backyard. Okay. Wow. See, I'm trying to do it. I'm looking at a picture and I'm confusing myself. Okay. The rooms on the second floor are as follows. The biggest room, which is Mr. and Mrs. Borden's room, the master bedroom. There's a doorway connecting the master bedroom with Mrs. Borden's dressing room. And then we have a separate bedroom that was Emma's bedroom, the older sister. Then we have Lizzie's bedroom next to that. So there's a doorway between Lizzie and Emma's bedroom. Then there's the guest room. That's where Mrs. Borden's body was found. Then we have the stairway going back downstairs, in between that and the dress closet, which is an entire room that was just Lizzo was there. That was just Lizzie and Emma's closet. It's an entire room. Even by today's standards, it's a big closet. So if that helped, you're welcome. If not, I'm sorry. So we walk in, and then to the left is the parlor room. It's like a formal living room. Everything is dark wood furniture, 1800s style. There's floral wallpaper, candles, presumably for lighting. There are red drapes over the window frames, and they're decorated in lace. And there is a small upright piano against the wall with sheet music displayed for the song you can't chop your papa up in Massachusetts. Among the oval ornate frames on the wall are portraits of city marshal at the time in the 1800s, Rufus Hilliard, and the mayor at the time, John Coughlin. These are the two who originally informed Miss Lizzie Borden that she was a suspect in the murder of her father and stepmother. Rufus, I may say, has a exquisite mustache. First, Lizzie was put on house arrest. They just said, don't go anywhere. And then a few days later, murder charges were given. She was charged for the murder of her father, Andrew Borden, and her stepmother, Abby. And then there was an additional charge for both of them. Seems redundant. That's what they did. The murders occurred in the summer of 1892 on August 4th into the late morning. After that, Lizzie spent 10 months in jail awaiting trial in Taunton, Massachusetts. Her trial, yes, this did go to trial, was in June of 1893 in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The Lizzie Borden trial was the first trial in the United States to ever be sent over the newswire, which meant it was national news, so everyone in the country was reading updates about it. The tour guide referred to it as the, quote, O.J. trial of its time, end quote. Oh yeah, O.J. just died. He was 76, prostate cancer. The juice is expired. Lizzie's jury was made up of 12 white men. There were no women on juries in the state of Massachusetts until the 1950s, and it took them 20 minutes to decide on a verdict of innocence, but they waited an hour and a half to announce it because that seemed more polite. The front parlor is also the room where the funerals for Andrew and Abby were hosted. They did everything in-house back then. It's said that Andrew Borden did well with his money. He actually came from a wealthy lineage, but he was on the less wealthy end in terms of his family. They made a lot of money through textiles, and Andrew did well for himself, but he was by no means opulent. The wealthiest of those in Massachusetts were up the hill. So in Fall River, there's the flats and the hills. So the Bordens lived in the flat area, and the wealthier people lived literally up the hill. So from the parlor room, you can go into the dining room. The house is a bit like a maze. Many rooms have interconnecting doors. On that morning in August, the last meal that the Bordens ate consisted of mutton broth. Mutton would be like lamb. Johnny cakes, cookies, crackers, and coffee. And at the table were three people. Andrew Borden, Abby Borden, and John Morse. John Morse was Lizzie's uncle. He didn't live there. He showed up the previous night, and he had stayed over. His visit that day was a surprise, but it wasn't uncommon for him to randomly visit. Lizzie was in the house, but she was not at the table for breakfast. She was in her room, possibly avoiding her stepmother. They didn't really get along. Emma, her older sister, was away visiting friends. After breakfast that morning, the Bordens went their separate ways, as did John Morse. Andrew ran business errands around town. Many people recalled seeing him doing so. Abby stayed home doing work around the house in her work dress. Just, can you even... A work dress. Fascinating. Uncle John went to go visit a niece and go to the post office. Lizzie once said about her father, quote, I never asked my father for anything I didn't get, although sometimes I had to ask a few times, end quote. Andrew had even bought the sisters a house on Ferry Street that eventually they no longer wanted. Their father had charged them 25 cents apiece for the house, and then he later bought it back from them for $5,000. So he essentially gave them a home, they didn't want it, and then he paid them for it, $5,000. when you're looking into the dining room, you can see on the back corner on the wall, hanging up there, is what looks like two antique window screens. They're rectangles with dark wooden frames and beige screens, but they are actually antique autopsy boards. The initial autopsies were done in the Borden house on the dining room table. Yeah. Different time. The initial autopsies consisted of removing the intestines and sending them to Harvard Medical to see if they had been poisoned, which was maybe just a practice they did anyway, I'm not sure, but the Bordens had been sick the previous days, like one after the other kind of thing, like food poisoning, so it wasn't out of nowhere that they would suspect that, so I don't know if that was just protocol or if they had been complaining of stomach issues, so they were just making sure. But yeah, the Bordens weren't feeling good leading up to this. The Bordens lived across the street from a doctor, Dr. Bowen, who witnessed the bodies that morning. At first, he had suspected the family had food poisoning since they had recently been sick, but when he got there, it was obviously much worse. Another framed portrait in the dining room is that of Eli Bentz. He was a pharmacist from the local drugstore who remembered Lizzie coming in the previous day, get this, before the murders, because she wanted to purchase something called prussic acid, which was a poison. And he said he couldn't sell it to her because it required a doctor's note. She was all irritated by that because she told him she bought it before and she only needed it to clean a seal skin coat. He said, maybe you did buy it before, but not for me. I'm not going to sell it to you. So she walked away in a huff, all disappointed. Suspicious timing, but maybe that wasn't a suspicious thing, just the timing. Make somebody raise an eyebrow. And as the tour guide is telling this story in the antique-looking dining room, he's standing beside a display cabinet that's centered on the back wall. Hanging above it is a still-life painting of oranges. And when you look in the display cabinet, in the center is a skull. And there is a large hole in the back left side. Along with that skull are photos of it from different angles. Believe it or not, the actual skulls of Andrew and Abby were used in the trial of Lizzie Borden. Some doctor, who I can't remember the name of now, had the unfortunate job of unearthing the bodies of Andrew and Abby Borden from their holding tombs. And then he decapitated them. And then he had to remove the flesh by boiling it in his kitchen. So many questions. Like, what? Okay, but that's what happened. And then they used the actual skulls and people. That was not a very comfortable thing for people in the courtroom. So, you couldn't have used paper mache or something just to illustrate your point? Nope. All right. What's even weirder is that when they did return the heads to the burial plots, they weren't reburied with the bodies. They were placed in their own containers, and then those containers were placed on top of the caskets, which I just think, I mean, you went through all the trouble and you're not even going to put the head back with the owner. I don't know. I would have. The dining room has a doorway to the sitting room, and the sitting room is where Andrew Borden was found on the black horsehair sofa, looking more like ground beef than a human being. That morning, before he found himself on that sofa for the last time, he actually couldn't get in the front door because the lock was stuck, even though he had a key. And the tour guide said, quote, to this day, that door gives us problems, end quote. Bridget Sullivan was the live-in maid. She was an Irish woman, and she had to let him in. Apparently, she made some remark in Gaelic before doing so, and she heard Lizzie laughing upstairs. Bridget unlocks the door. Andrew steps in. Lizzie said she helped her father get situated for a nap by drawing the curtains. Maybe she took off his boots. Maybe she didn't. She also said that morning she was in the barn in their backyard eating pears. Another account is she was looking for something to fashion fishing lures. There was also an ironing board set out on the dining room table because she was ironing cloths. Not really sure exactly what Lizzie was doing that morning, but she was home. She was in the house. When she was in the backyard, supposedly eating pears, after about 15 minutes, she said she heard a groan from inside the house and a scraping sound. And then when she came in, that's when she saw her father and called for Bridget to go get help. A neighbor saw Lizzie Borden in distress at the side door of her house, and she saw the neighbor, and Lizzie said, quote, "Oh, Mrs. Churchill, do come over. Someone has killed Father," end quote. Then this lady just goes over there, which I find fascinating. Like, I'm not from that time. I feel like that's probably one of the first things you could say to keep me out of your house, but not Mrs. Churchill. I guess she just scurried on over there. Maybe Lizzie was just freaking out, didn't know what to do. I don't know. So there's a crime scene photo that's still in the Borden house today, and it's the photo of Andrew Borden on the sofa, dead. And what's peculiar about the photo is that he has his boots on. His legs are off the sofa, his feet are pretty much on the floor, and he's wearing his boots. So did he never take them off? Did Lizzie take them off? Did she not? And she thought she did? Then I'm thinking, in the photo, his feet aren't on the sofa, so maybe he purposely left his feet off. There's also the possibility that he wasn't wearing his boots, and whoever came upon his body first, so that would probably be Dr. Bowen. I think he was the first to attend to the bodies. He wasn't the first to see them, but he did examine them, so he could have theoretically put the boots on to preserve Mr. Borden's image or something. When Lizzie gave her inquest testimony, she was under the influence of something called bromocaffeine, which I think is a mild painkiller like Advil or something. And then later, Dr. Bowen gave her morphine, which would impair one's testimony and would be totally illegal now. But, I mean, they're using actual human skulls in the courtroom, so who knows what the guidelines were. So going over the morning of the murders, we have Lizzie somewhere in the house. We have Bridget Sullivan, the maid, upstairs taking a nap. Then we have Mrs. Churchill come over, who is the neighbor. And then at some point, her best friend Alice Russell came over. And then we have Dr. Bowen. I'm not exactly sure about that order, but people are just traipsing through there. If you go into the sitting room of the house, there is a photo of the famous handleless hatchet. It's just the head of a hatchet. There's no handle to it. And that was found in the basement of the Borden home. There was rust on it and there was blood on it, but the blood appeared to be animal blood, and it is not considered the murder weapon. Which is another thing about this lovely little antique story. It was never an axe. It was presumably a hatchet because, well, although the damage would look similar between an axe and a hatchet, an axe is so much heavier. And, I mean, it's used to chop wood. So you can just imagine what an axe would do to a person's face as opposed to a hatchet. Sorry if you're eating. The only original windows to the house are in the sitting room. I did previously think that all of the windows were original to the home, but that's not true. They do have the original windows in the sitting room, though, and those would be the exact same windows that the maid, Bridget, was washing that morning before she had let Mr. Borden in. All the woodwork and doors are original to the home. Andrew Borden did something interesting. With the key that he had to his bedroom door, he would leave it on the mantle in the sitting room. Apparently, it was a time where people locked their interior doors, or at least the Bordens did so. We'll get back to that a little bit later. Back to the entryway and then go up the winding wooden staircase. The only design difference today is that there is no more carpeting on the stairs. They were carpeted during the time of the Borden murders. About an hour and a half after Mr. Borden was discovered in the sitting room, Bridget and the neighbor, Mrs. Churchill, walked up the stairs and saw the body of Abby Borden in the guest room. As you walk up those stairs, you can actually peer through the wooden spindles and see through the doorway of the guest room under the bed where Abby Borden lay dead. Then we go into that guest room. That's where Uncle John had slept the night before, and Abby was in there making up the bedspread in her work dress. The initial blow is suspected to be to her cheek, and it is referred to as the quote-unquote flap wound. After this initial blow, she hit the floor, and then it was at least 18 whacks. 17 of them hit her in the face and head. One of them hit her in the shoulder. She was killed much more aggressively than Andrew, and she was killed first. The tour guide said people booked that room years in advance, and some people even liked to sleep on the floor exactly where Abby was murdered. I mean, whatever you're into. Crime scenes were not preserved back in the day the way they are today, unless you were working the Ramsey case and didn't really give a crap about anything anywhere. Bodies were covered for the sake of modesty, which now we wouldn't do that because everything is evidence. And crime scene photos were taken well after the fact of the crime itself. Uncle John arrived back at the home around 11:40 a.m., saw the commotion because people were noticing outside, and they even had to position an officer by the back door. So he sees all of this and then went to the backyard and ate some pears. Why he would do something like that when there was clearly something wrong, I don't know. He was definitely not home at the time of the murders, though. Several people confirmed his whereabouts about town. On the wall of the guest room, back where Abby was whacked, between the bed and the dresser is a framed photo of the crime scene, and the photographer is reflected in the mirror in the background. Before Andrew Borden had moved in 1875, after paying $10,000 for the house, it was a multi-family home, and he made it into a single-family home again. He also blocked the fireplace in the master bedroom for some reason, and it's still like that today because, quote-unquote, 1872 rules apply, the tour guide said. Lizzie and Emma had a huge closet. It was its own room. And then the sisters' bedrooms had a doorway that connected. Maybe that's why they locked the interior doors, because you could get from one room to the other most of the time. I don't know. So not many people know this, but it wasn't Lizzie Borden gave her mother 40 whacks. That's, first of all, that's very excessive, not to mention exhausting. But it wasn't her mother, it was her stepmother. Sarah was the birth mother of both Lizzie and Emma Borden, and she died when Lizzie was 2 and Emma was 11. So Lizzie Borden didn't really have much memories of her. Emma probably did, though. After Lizzie returned from a 19-week trip to Europe fully funded by her father, the girls switched rooms and Lizzie got the bigger room. Also, the master bedroom is the only bedroom in the house with a bathroom that is connected. When the Bordens lived there, there were no bathrooms. They used chamber pots and an outhouse by the barn. Fortunately, they do have indoor plumbing, Wi-Fi, and streaming now. What was a dressing room for Abby / office for Andrew is now a bedroom that is across from the master bedroom. And that is the room that a year before someone had broken into the house and took things only from that one room, the upstairs guest bedroom, you could call it now. They took the equivalent of $70 to $80, trolley tickets, coins, menial things like that. The bizarre thievery might explain why Andrew left the key to his room on the mantle, as if he knew it was an inside job and someone in the house had done it. There's also a building in Fall River that's pretty much in the center of town. It's still there today. It's the AJ Borden Building. He didn't own that property for very long before he was murdered, and then it was inherited by Lizzie. Upstairs is pretty much just the attic. It was Bridget Sullivan's room. There's a slanted ceiling up there. It would have been hot in the summer, cold in the winter kind of thing. The tour guide said that relatives of Bridget had visited the Borden home maybe like a decade or so ago. And they said Bridget had died when she was 82 in 1948. And she never talked about Lizzie after the trial and everything. Bridget ended up moving to Montana and she married a guy named John Sullivan. She didn't have any kids of her own, and her nieces said she was a very stern woman and one of them called her mean. There's also a Jennings room and a Knowlton room named after the prosecution and defense attorneys in Lizzie's trial. Then there was this thing with pigeons. So there's a plaque, I believe it's on the first floor, maybe the second. It just said something like, two pigeons found here. And then the date is something in the 90s, like somebody came in the house and found two dead pigeons, which is weird, but is mostly nothing. But then in the trial, there was questions on whether or not Andrew was cruel to the pigeons that they kept, but it's still unclear if it was their livestock or if they were Lizzie's pets. Still, it's pretty weird to find two dead birds in the house. That feels like an omen, doesn't it? So then we have the basement. And then you go downstairs and then there's this room that the tour guides refer to as the quote-unquote under the hatchet room, because blood from that sofa upstairs directly above had soaked through the floorboards into the basement. You can still see some of it in the floorboards. That's like centuries old blood just hanging out. Many people had actually lived in the house after the Bordens. And one guy was doing work on the house and he, I would do this, he hid a hatchet in the wall and then one of the workers found it and was convinced he had discovered the murder weapon. The guy let him believe it for like an hour before he told him that he had done it. In the basement, it is dark, it is cramped. There's lots of stuff down there. It looks like storage stuff. The night of the murders, Lizzie Borden had stayed in that house, as did Uncle John, which apparently was just what people did. Also, her friend Alice Russell stayed over. And there was, I guess, what we would think of as a toilet of sorts in the basement. It was probably just a hole in the ground or something close to that. And there was an officer outside watching the house to see if whoever had quote-unquote broken in would come back. And he observed kerosene lights coming down the stairs, like gas lamps, I guess. Are those the same thing? I don't know. So the officer outside observes kerosene lights coming down the stairs, and then they go up again. 15 minutes later, he sees one kerosene light, and that's being carried by Lizzie Borden, who returned to the basement alone. She didn't go to the side with the bathroom area. She went to the other side of the basement where there's a sink sort of set up. And then upon seeing this, the officer that was outside crept around to the back windows just to see what she was doing in the basement by herself when she was just down there with her best friend. Why didn't she just do it then? I don't know. So he's just peeking through the windows or whatever. Which, if I had seen that, I would probably have a heart attack. Just two little eyeballs looking at me. Oh, man. So, Lizzie is observed by the sink. And she's only there for maybe a minute. That's where they would have put the victim's clothes at the time, on the floor, until they were later buried. Apparently, they buried clothes back then. That's what they did with them. The tour guide talked about their previous resident, who was a cat. His name was Maxwell Borden, and he has since passed away. And he was, quote, a good little fellow, end quote. And then we have the kitchen. So we go back up, we go to the kitchen. And the kitchen is where Lizzie had showed her sister Emma a dress that was covered in, quote, reddish brown paint, end quote. And she asked her sister if she should burn it. And I guess Emma was like, whatever, it's ruined, go ahead and burn it. Which I don't think it was something that people did. Like, you could burn clothes, but I don't think you would make it a practice to do so. But maybe it wasn't a big deal because they had a giant room as a closet. So why not burn it? And then her friend Alice observed her doing this with the dress and thought it was not a good look. And then she later said that in her testimony that she saw Lizzie burning a dress in the kitchen. I don't think they were besties after that. Another peculiar thing is the night before Andrew and Abby were hatcheted to death, Lizzie had gone over to Alice's house and was venting to her about a bunch of paranoia she had that something bad was going to happen. So, do we think she was having a premonition of sorts? Or was this foreshadowing? Was she setting it up so she could knock it down? I don't know. After the harrowing events, Lizzie and her sister Emma lived together. Not in that house, but they bought a house up the hill and named it Maplecroft. They lived together for over a decade until Emma moved out in 1905. Apparently, there was a disagreement, and it's believed they never spoke again. Emma ended up living in New Hampshire, and Lizzie never left that house, known as Maplecroft, so she lived in Fall River before, during, and after all the drama. The tour guide explained that Lizzie loved animals, she had a terrier, she was a very generous and kind person to people she knew and her close circle of friends. She also frequently donated to animal outreaches in Fall River, Massachusetts, and she died at the age of 66 in 1927 from a series of health problems. In her will, she had requested to be buried at the feet of her father in Oak Grove Cemetery, and that is where she lays today by the people she was accused and acquitted of murdering. Her sister Emma is buried there too. Emma was 9 years older than Lizzie and died 9 days after Lizzie. Will we ever know what truly happened? Who knows? We could. Maybe. It's possible. We kind of know, but we kind of don't. What I can tell you is Lizzie Borden had a grave for her dogs, and it's still there in Boston. Well, that is a brief history of the Lizzie Borden home in Fall River, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for listening. I'm so glad I got to tell you this story. I cannot wait to tell you another. Oh, I forgot to talk about the edible thing. I'll save the edible story for part two. Until then, I will see you next Tuesday.